when I'm in the execution chamber, I don't feel like I'm just there with the guy who is being executed. It feels like I'm also there with all the guys that I have accompanied. It's as if we're all going in there together.
Doing. It's not what I'm going to do, Brandon. It's what society's going to do. I don't know what that'll be, but I can guess.
My name is John, and this is Radical Empathy. How long has it been? It's been 4 years since I released the last episode of this podcast. And if you're listening to this, thank you for your patience. And we're back.
Henry!
Where were you? Why did you call? Where have you been? We were worried to death.
Where do we begin? So much has happened. I have changed as a person since the last episode. I got married. And I had probably the biggest life change of all, which is becoming a parent.
What do you call this language? The name of the language is longer than the first sentence.
How do you say hello in your language?
And how do
you say goodbye?
Goodbye.
Oh, it's the same. It's the same as English.
And I also stepped down from my role as creative director at Jubilee Media, relocated to Chicago, and left Los Angeles. But before I left, Jason and I had a great conversation, and we agreed that it was time to do Radical Empathy again. So I'm very grateful for this opportunity to have this platform again, to have this podcast, to have you here. With your willingness to listen to me and my thoughts and the thoughts of my guests, and I'm going to do my best to deliver you some thought-provoking discussions. All right, so my first guest back is the Reverend Dr. Jeff Hood. In 2016, he was a somewhat controversial figure. He was one of the organizers of a Black Lives Matter rally that tragically resulted in a mass shooting where five police officers were killed. Some comments he had made the day previously went viral when they were aired on Fox News.
God damn America. White America.
White America is a f***ing lie.
I'm not tying the shooter's behavior to them, but you have regret over those now in the wake of what happened.
Yeah, I think obviously if I had to go and do it over again, I think I would have chose different words.
But the controversy aside, Reverend Jeff has been very focused in recent years on advocating against the death penalty in the United States, and he is actually now allowed to be present with inmates at the time of their execution. He's one of a very small group of people in America who has witnessed multiple executions firsthand, and that's why I invited him on the show, and that's what we're going to talk about today. This podcast is not meant to tell you what to believe, tell you what is right, tell you what is wrong. It's really an opportunity for you to take a walk in someone else's mind. I really hope that you can live inside Reverend Jeff's experiences and thoughts as you listen to him, and then walk away with your own unique point of view and critical perspective. So without further ado, here's my conversation with the Reverend Jeff Hood.
My name is Reverend Dr. Jeff Hood. I am a spiritual advisor to various men on death row across the country. And I am an old Catholic priest. I grew up Baptist, was ordained a Baptist minister in a Southern Baptist church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always say that my top vocations are as a dad and as a husband. We have five children, twins that are 11, a 9-year-old, and twins that are 8. And so before anybody asks the question, in the old Catholic Church, priests are married with kids. And so, well, I don't know if everybody's got kids, but I have kids.
Should I call you Reverend Jeff or just Jeff? What's the best way to...
John, you can call me whatever you want. Just you can even call me an asshole if you'd like. There's a plenty of people who do.
Well, hopefully we don't get to that point. how long have you been doing this specific type of work with death row inmates?
I've been working with guys on death row for over a decade. Mm-hmm. But only in the last couple of years have I gone into the execution chamber and been with guys while they're executed. I connect with someone in the last 3 to 6 months of their lives and advocate. I mean, always advocate for them not to be executed. But I encounter them in the last 3 to 6 months of their life, and my job is to become their best friend. Mm-hmm. And I become their best friend in order to be with them when they die or when they're murdered, when they're executed. And so, yeah, it's complicated. And I'll also say that there's not a lot of textbooks or, there's no manuals on how to do this because there's not a lot of people who do this.
What struck me when I heard you on the radio was just, your willingness to be so adjacent to death, which is something I think is very counterintuitive to the majority of humans. We really, I think, do everything we can to run away from death.
I don't see myself as having this super great proximity to death. I see myself as having this super great proximity to life. In that, in those final days, in those final moments, they're so packed full of life that most people do not even come close to living like that. With this idea that this countdown, that every second is meaningful, valuable. I mean, I think it's taught me so much about being present in the midst of life. One of the things that we forget is just how thin the veil between life and death is. As humans, we like to assume that there is this fortified concrete wall between us and death. And I think that such thinking is rather absurd, because we know for a fact that our ancestors, we know that they don't ever leave us. I mean, trauma is contained in the bones. We know that there is this long genetic code that if you're talking about this, I guess, from a purely scientific perspective, we are all that we have been, and we are all that we are or will ever be. That, Einstein told us that there is nothing that is ever created or destroyed, that energy is, eternal. And certainly love is the greatest energy of all. And so when we think about who God is, what God is, when we experience love, we are experiencing certainly the divine and something eternal. And with these guys, the thing that that I experienced with them, the deep love and connection that I experienced with them, is very eternal. I always talk about how when I'm in the execution chamber, I don't feel like I'm just there with the the guy who is being executed. It feels like I'm also there with all the guys that I have accompanied. It's as if we're all going in there together.
How many executions have you witnessed firsthand?
So the Supreme Court just allowed people to witness, but spiritual advisors to be in the execution chamber with the folks that they ministered to about 2.5 years ago. And since then, I've been in the execution chamber with five guys. I will be preparing to be with my sixth guy at the beginning of April or next month. I have another guy that is scheduled for June, and then I have another guy that is scheduled for December.
Has death been something that's existed in your life long before?
Yeah, you know, I don't know that I had any sort of, like, you know, proclivity about me with regards to death when I was young, but I do know that when you grow up in a evangelical space, death is always close because death is the great motivator to follow Jesus. You know, they used to tell us all the time, if you were to die right now, where would you go? Heaven or hell? And, you know, that used to always, like, scare the shit out of me, to be quite frank. One of our dogs had puppies, and one of the puppies didn't make it. And I was just so devastated because I just couldn't understand why God would do that. I mean, I had this existential crisis when I was, like, 6 or 7 years old. I remember just simply not being able to make peace with that, and, of course, based on our church, I couldn't help but wonder if the puppy was in puppy hell or puppy heaven. And then, you know, on another hand, there was a gentleman at our church that committed suicide. But they had always told us that if you committed suicide, you went to hell. Until somebody in the church committed suicide.
Right.
And then they sort of wanted to, you know, rethink their theology. And I remember, obviously being devastated that this person had committed suicide back then. But I also remember being sort of relieved that the goalpost could move a little bit.
There was some elasticity around that.
Yeah, there was some elasticity, some grace there. You know, when I recount all the stories from, like, when I was a kid, you know, it is humorous, but it also just shows how much people want to get away from death. People's idea of Jesus and God and religion, they want to talk about so much heaven, yet they make life hell for people down here. It poisons the mind to believe that life is not important, that our lives are about preparation for death. And I think that a lot of the bullshit that I grew up with in a more evangelical context prepared me for this work, to make peace with death and also to make peace with life.
When you meet these people who you become a spiritual guide and friend for, usually, how do you begin the conversation about their past, and how do you start to build trust with them?
You know, John, when someone's entire life is, you know, centered on something that they did, or in some cases, something that they didn't do. I mean, it is important to continue to say that.
Yeah.
When such is so apparent, I mean, it you know, it's always naturally comes up. Because they're talking about their case, they're talking about their execution, they're talking about maybe wanting to, you know, apologize or get in touch with the victim's family, or, you know, there's all sorts of ways that these things are discussed. You know, a lot of my guys, they do get to this place of, I've been apologizing for 20 or 30 years. Why do I, you know, have to keep on apologizing? And my response is always, when you murder someone, you don't get to get tired of apologizing. Mm. And, you know, and sometimes maybe that apology isn't for you. You know, you've made peace and you've asked for forgiveness and you feel God's grace and mercy in your life. But, you know, such apologies are for the people that hear them.
Has there ever been a crime or something that you know one of your clients has done that is very difficult for you to look past or that you have to process with them?
You know, it's interesting when you use that word clients, because I think yeah. it's something that I've long struggled with. What do I call my relationship with these guys?
Yeah, I wasn't sure either.
You know, so I've really tried to settle on friend, because okay. I feel like that most encapsulates the relationship I have with these guys. There is a wild story of a guy who was the serial killer of children in Texas that I worked with a long time ago. And we get to talking and we had a great visit and great conversation. And I said, is there anything else I can do for you or help you with? And he said, yeah, he said, you can send me a picture of your kids. And I mean, that was definitely a moment where I was like, you know, a very difficult moment. It reminds me of when all of the disciples are looking at Jesus and some begin to leave. And Jesus looks at the core group of disciples that would remain and he says, are you going to leave too? And when I face situations like that of the gentleman in Texas, it's almost as if this person is looking at me and saying, are you going to leave too?
Wow.
We should be furious and angry about injustice. Whether that's the murder of people by a perpetrator, a guy on death row, or whether that's the murder of a person on death row by the state. Occasionally I meet someone that, hell, at first, when I first read of the crime and first meet them, I could see how people would want to execute them. I could see how you know, somebody could get to the point where they wanted to execute them themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the nature of this work is that those emotions are human, but they don't have to define us. It's human, it's natural to feel anger and even rage in the midst of injustice.
Mm-hmm.
But we are also defined by our response to such things.
Did you end up choosing to send that person a photo of your family and your kids, or did you enforce a boundary?
Fuck no.
How do you hold that duality of these people who are your friends? The evil that they have done and maybe like the evil that still lingers within them, but also this divine spark that you see within them that is worth defending.
You know, it's not just a duality, it's a multiplicity of alities, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a sense in which yeah, it's very, very complicated. But I encourage people to take a second and to stop and think, what relationship do you have that's not complicated?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we choose to engage each other, it's always complicated. These guys, their faults are just a lot more apparent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can't wear the mask, whereas we all are very comfortable with our masks.
What's the mask?
Whoever we choose to be in public, whoever we choose to portray ourselves as to each other. And that's sort of what makes it different than, you know, a lot of relationships out here. I mean, John, I don't know what the worst thing you've done in your life is. I'm sure you probably don't lead with that, the first conversation you have with people. but these guys have to. You know, they don't get that choice. And so I think that, when I talk about mask, I'm talking about the ability to be private about
your flaws.
Your flaws, the awful things that you've done.
Has your family met any of the people who you've been spiritual guides for, or are there boundaries?
I mean, they talked, you know, interesting, glad you asked that. They talk to them on the phone. I mean, they actually sort of become a part of our family in a way. And that's wow. That's an interesting thing that obviously most families don't get to experience. And that doesn't mean I'm going to, you know, put them in a cell with these guys. It doesn't mean that, you know, even that I would be interested in a lot of these guys living next door to us. But it does mean that there is a common humanity that I want our kids to know of. And I think that at our best, families are this sort of extension of God's love. And when we share that with people, it can be redemptive.
How can you describe what it's like to witness an execution? What is an execution in the United States like?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to state that they're not all the same. With a lethal injection, obviously, that looks different than the nitrogen hypoxia.
Where are you? I mean, I don't even understand how these scenarios are. You know, are you seated? Are you standing?
I'm never seated, but it depends. Where I'm standing depends on the state. Oklahoma, for instance, I'll go there first. Scott Eisenberg, that was the first. And when I came into the room, I was ushered to, you know, next to him, and I stood next to him. He's on a gurney. The gurney is in this sort of pseudo crucifix position, which is very bizarre. You know, this very puritanical, like, sort of cross position. I begin to pray with him, and I'm able to touch him, to engage with him. You know, the interesting thing is in that moment, I'm close enough to the mechanisms to where I can reach out and touch, you know, the poison. Wow. Or at least the machines that deliver the poisons. And in those moments, I sit there and I pray. You know, when I talk, I tell how much, tell these guys how much I love them and, you know, how meaningful they are to me and how important they are to me. And, you know, and that's just very, yeah, it's very, very hard because they're looking at you and they know that, I mean, they're about to be killed. And, you know, how do you say something to someone that makes them about to be murdered any less heavy or weighty? I mean, I don't know what the right word is. It's the oppression and injustice that exists in that moment is horrific.
How, you know, how are they usually? Are they calm? Are they, have they submitted to it, or are they very resistant?
Depends on who you're talking about.
Yeah, it's different.
It's different every time. Mm-hmm. I've dealt with folks who are agitated and folks who are, you know, very calm. I mean, I have one guy who, he was so calm, it was like he was sleeping, you know, sort of going in and out and in and out. And I always read the story of the adulterous woman. So I start talking about, you who are without sin, cast the first stone. Now, I ain't never stopped an execution in that way. I ain't never had them, you know, put down the poison and walk out of the room. But I do want these guys to know that you can't claim Jesus, you can't claim any level of righteousness and continue with this. You can't kill somebody and call it good. And then I'll also engage with the words of Jesus in John, "Let not your heart be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. For in my Father's house," I want these guys to understand that that the lights, the poison, the gurney is not the end. And then I'm ushered to the back of the room. You know, I'm invited to continue to pray and talk. And when the actual moment of execution happens, and this is a lethal injection, not the nitrogen hypoxia. Nitrogen hypoxia is much more visceral than a lethal injection. But one of the things I saw with Scott was it was almost like the colors of the rainbow were going through his face. I mean, it was almost like a bag of Skittles going through his face. I mean, he went from white to yellow to green to red to blue over and over until he finally went back to white, you know, a very deep white. And it's like watching the stages of someone dying of death just play out viscerally in front of you under these, you know, white, super like LED type lights. You know, in the midst of all of this, you can see everybody who's watching.
How many people are watching?
And there's probably 10 people in what looks like a closet, all up at the window trying to see. It's very strange to watch human beings jockeying for position to watch someone die. The way that these guys' faces look, the way that their eyebrows move or their lips are pursed or open or whatever. I mean, you know, I see them. Like, their faces stick with me forever. You know, so it's physically quite painful for me. It's not like, I mean, there's a physiological reaction that I have.
You receive any sort of therapy for that?
I have, and there are people, you know, who are therapists that I talk to on a regular basis. I'll also say, and I don't really want to get too far into this, but the nitrogen hypoxia execution was, it made lethal injections look like, you know, a walk in the park. In his face, I mean, there was veins popping out, eyeballs were, you know, thrusting forward. His face was hitting the mask over and over again. I mean, it was unbelievably violent. And, you know, I'm expected to just sort of sit there and hang out. I mean, it was the most disturbing thing I think I've ever seen.
I'm sorry. Reverend Jeff was just referring to the execution of Kenneth Smith in Alabama earlier this year. It was the first execution of its kind using nitrogen gas.
I think the human heart has an ability to identify murder, sort of festers in our spirit. And I think that probably one of the most difficult aspects of what I do is being in that room and feeling like I'm part of the system, the process, and feeling like I'm complicit.
As somebody who's witnessed these things firsthand, been as close as you really can be to an execution, why do you so firmly believe that it's not a form of justice?
I mean, somebody who is executed is completely helpless. The execution of a murderer isn't all that different from the execution of a baby. They're immobilized, completely helpless, and there's an intentional killing of them. And I would think the only difference between those two murders is that the baby doesn't have as much understanding of what's coming. Oh God, people definitely put that in there. People really get pissed off by me saying that. You know, these executions say a lot more about us than they do about the person being executed. These executions are not about the unrighteousness of the person being executed. They are a question of whether the executioners consider themselves to be righteous enough to be doing the executing. And I think that what I feel and see every time is a proud society, a proud culture, who think that they are big enough, moral enough to kill each other.
Family of the victim might choose to watch an execution. Have you ever spoken to them or had dialogue?
Many times. And I can tell you that I have never, ever met a victim's family who has said, I want to watch that again. And I've also encountered family members who have watched these things and they have said, I am so sorry that I did not realize what I was doing by pushing for this.
There have been people who have actually regretted it after.
Yeah, absolutely. You are viscerally seeing someone tied down and their life extinguished right before your eyes. And it's shocking. It's absolutely shocking. You know, regardless of what your opinion is on Gaza and Israel and Palestine, and I realize I'm going afoot here by saying this, but
it did cross my mind in some of the things you've said.
You know, you look at Gaza and you look at these people dying, starving to death, being shot, bombed. I mean, just the horrors of what is happening in Gaza. And for that matter, what the horrors of what happened on October the 7th in Israel. There's no way to look at that and say, oh, yeah, that's good. I'm really glad that that's happening. John, I'm telling you, and you better make sure you put this in there. This is the only thing I'm going to say. You better make sure you put this in there.
Okay, I'll make sure.
The problem with the death penalty is that there is such a disconnect between this idea of punishment and the punishment actually being carried out. You know, if they had to do it themselves, there would be no death sentences. When you're able to sit in judgment of other people and decide who lives and dies and not have to get your hands dirty, then of course it's easy to execute people. Only way to bring about justice is by bringing people close. And I think that that's part of my job, is to let people know that Scott Eisenberg, Arthur Brown, Anthony Sanchez, Casey McWhorter, Kenny Smith, these are human beings and who made mistakes and who are just as human as any of the rest of us.
And some of the criticism that you have received is that some people felt that you were acting as a wedge between their attorneys or their legal counsel and them, your friends. And then I've also heard you're doing this work to seek fame. What are your responses to those things?
Yeah, I mean, important questions. I mean, I think that if I am in a relationship with someone on death row and they tell me that their lawyer hasn't spoken to them in 6 years and they say, I need a new attorney. I mean, I would have to be the biggest asshole on earth to say, I'm not going to help you with that. I have habeas attorneys or appellate attorneys that I work very closely with, who are dear friends. And they are always in these situations offering, you know, counsel and advice on how to deal with these situations. I never function in any of these spaces alone. And, you know, but I will say that, look, if you hadn't talked to your client in 6 years, I have one case in Tennessee of 13 years, John, somebody sitting on death row trying to call and get in touch with their attorney for 13 years. Years and hearing nothing. You better hope they don't call me. You better hope they don't call me, because we're going to be at your door with a bunch of cameras, microphones. We're going to be bringing all your friends and family to say, this is wrong. I guess you could probably hear from all of the language I'm using why an attorney every once in a while might not like me.
Well, yeah, and in the beginning, you know, you mentioned that some people might refer to you as an asshole. So, you know,
yeah.
I mean, well, I appreciate you addressing it. The other side of the criticism was that, the fame, or that there's a performative aspect to your ministry.
My job is to get these guys as much attention as possible, to bring as much attention as possible to these circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. If I was most interested in my fame, I would, you know, go streaking on, you know, during the Super Bowl or something like that. I mean, I can think of a lot of other ways to be famous than watching people die.
Reverend Dr. Jeff Hood, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for being on Radical Empathy, and you'll be in my thoughts as you continue to do this work, as well as your friends.
It's been a beautiful, beautiful time. It's always great and meaningful and moving and beautiful to engage. And, you know, let me put it quite frank, John, it's nice to be, capital B, capital E, with you.
Likewise, it was nice to be with you as well. All right, and that wraps our first episode of season 2. Thank you again for sitting down and giving me your time 4 years later. I promise it won't be another 4 years before another episode comes back. We're actually planning on releasing multiple seasons this year in 2024, so please stick around, tell your family, tell your friends about Radical Empathy, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you're interested in sending us a voice message that could be used in a future episode, either a question that you want me to answer, a point of critical feedback, something that you feel is important to say, or if you want to reach out because you have a story or experience that you think would be great for a future episode, you can leave us a voice message at 312-945-6738. If you're also interested in seeing more of my content, you can find my personal YouTube channel under my name, John Regalado, and you can also follow me on X, where I'll be more active this year. Don't forget to subscribe to Jubilee, watch Jubilee content. I think that's it. I'm done spamming you for now. Thank you so much. Until next time, over and out.
When I stand before God and he asks me why did I kill one of his true miracles, what am I going to say? That it was my job.